remember it was like December, and I had just made like $12,000, like writing like 5 or 6 articles for the month. And I was like, why do I need a job?
You're listening to the Next Generation Podcast, weekly interviews with the most interesting and successful 20-somethings out there.
Hey, I'm Nathan Resnick. I'm the founder of Sourcify. We are an 8-figure run rate business, and I also started Bubble Hotels. We're a glamping business, and you're listening to the Next Generation Podcast.
Hell yeah. All right, Nathan, I'm excited to have you on the show, man. You were someone I've wanted to talk to for quite a bit of time now, and like us, you do a lot of different projects, everything from sourcing companies to e-commerce to building up these really cool boutique hotels. And you just got your hands on a lot of different things, which I definitely like talking with people like yourself. So let's jump right into things. You know, first off, I want to kind of start off with Sourcify, because this is probably your longest standing business, if I'm correct, where you've been running for what, like 5 or 6 years?
Yeah, about 5.5 years now.
So let's kick things off by talking about, like, okay, first of all, one, what is Sourcify? And then I want to kind of dive into how Sourcify is navigating the world right now, because a lot of people might have heard the news around the supply chain crisis, and, you know, they might notice that their favorite products are out of stock. But for the most part, that's kind of where it ends. People don't really know too much of what's going on. So I'd love to hear about some of the founding stories behind Sourcify and where y'all are at today.
Yeah, I mean, my journey into e-commerce really actually starts in high school. So I was a foreign exchange student in China, my junior year of high school, from when I was 15 to 16 years old, living with a host family, didn't speak English, attending a local school right outside Beijing. And, you know, the reason I kind of did that is I wasn't the best student growing up, and never really was. And so my neighbor did a foreign exchange program the year before me, and, you know, our parents were talking, and they thought it'd be great for me. And it was. I mean, I became so fascinated that year by how products were made. My host dad was a engineer at a, you know, manufacturing company, and I just got so curious in how products were produced. And so actually in 2010, when I was 15, I started importing products and selling them on eBay and Amazon. We actually would mostly import fake products at that time. So we'd go to all these knockoff markets and sell, you know, I think we were the largest seller of Beats by Dr. Dre headphones on eBay in 2010.
This is when you were 15.
Yeah, when I was 15. So they were like legit, like, you know, we tested sound quality, everything was the same, but, you know, we were buying them for like $30, $40 a pop and selling them for, you know, $250, $300 on eBay. And we were getting good reviews, you know, but when I moved back to America after that year, you know, really realized that in order to grow and build a real business, I needed to create my own brand. And so started a watch company and sunglasses brand in college, and that, you know, did pretty well. I think we grew to like maybe $300K or $400K in revenue through college. And then sold that when I graduated college. And when I was running these e-commerce brands and importing products, people would always ask me, you know, how do you manufacture a product in China? I realized that was a pretty fun problem to solve in order to, you know, make it more efficient and optimize it. So in 2017, about a year after I graduated college, I started Sourcify. And, you know, we've become the most known e-commerce sourcing platform. We help a few hundred brands manufacture products in China, Vietnam, India, and Pakistan. So we have 4 different offices in Asia, and work with everyone from, you know, Jackson, the men's jewelry brand, to, you know, we do the Budweiser and Bud Light program for Anheuser-Busch. You know, we also help a lot of people that are just looking to figure out how to turn an idea to a product with our product sourcing school. So we have an educational program that over 3,000 people have been through to, you know, learn the ins and outs of manufacturing a product themselves.
Man, that's amazing. Today's podcast is sponsored by Privy. They are the number one most reviewed app on the Shopify App Store and a necessity if you want to grow your e-commerce business. Now, before I started using Privy on all of my Shopify stores, I was seeing maybe a 1% conversion rate because I was spending so much time and money driving traffic to my store and not capturing any customer information. And after Privy, that all changed. Now my store converts at 3% plus, sometimes in the holidays, even as high as 5 or 6%. And it's because Privy helps me capture customer emails on my site and then allows me to go and actually use email flows to remind them to finish their purchase. So now I'm not just burning money on Facebook and Google ads. If you run an e-commerce store today, you literally cannot afford to not be using Privy. Head on over to privy.com/next generation for your free trial today.
I want to dive into everything of where y'all are at today and like what it takes to start a foreign office and even just like some of the mistakes people are making along the way. But like, what I can't let go right now is like no other 15-year-old for the most part is out there becoming like the number one like knockoff distributor for different brands. Like I don't know, when I was 15, I was just focused on like video games and sports pretty much. I'm really curious, was this just something that you were always like innately passionate about? Or
yeah, I mean, you know, neither of my parents are entrepreneurs, but even in middle school, like I used to buy Livestrong, like fake Livestrong bracelets and stuff from China. Like, you know, it's kind of bad looking back on it, but I would literally buy like bulk of like 100, you know, bands and resell them for like, you know, $3, $4, or $5 a pop. And like, I don't know, probably on 100 bands, I could make like $300, $400, or $500 in profit, like in middle school. And I was always flipping stuff, you know, that was kind of like my side hustle. And then I became really into sneakers. I actually got, you know, kind of a sneakerhead. And so, you know, was doing everything, you know, kind of in like the Nice Kicks community and all these different, you know, sneakerhead forums and whatnot. And so then, you know, when I was living in China, there was just so much access to like really good fake products. And I knew eBay pretty well just from having, you know, sold things on there before in middle school and earlier on in high school. And yeah, we just go to these, you know, markets and we started building relationships with vendors because they were like, how are you guys coming back, you know, every weekend and buying dozens of these headphones? And, you know, we started with an array of products at first, like, you know, polos or Lacoste shirts or whatever it may be. But like those headphones, you know, for whatever reason, they like sold like hotcakes, and also the margin was amazing. And the quality was really good too. I mean, like we were getting good reviews on eBay, even though they weren't like, you know, the real deal. And we didn't know better. I mean, we were, you know, 15 years old. And you know, to be honest, like we didn't, the first business that I really had to file taxes for and keep track of everything for was, you know, a watch and sunglass brand that I started in college. It was actually called Yes Man Watches. And yeah, I sold it for like, I don't know, I think it was like 35-40K when I graduated college, and took that money, spent half of it traveling Europe for like 9 months, just partying and having fun. And the other half I actually bought Shopify stock with when it was like,
nice, there you go.
And, yeah, I made a killing on that stock. So because I was using Shopify when I was running that, you know, e-com brand. So it worked out.
Having done all these startups since you were 15, did you go into college knowing that you wanted to kind of have a career as a entrepreneur? Or did you kind of have mixed feelings in terms of you might get a job after and then, you know, had some success along the way?
You know, it's a really good question. So everyone in kind of college, I went to school at the University of San Diego. I was like such a bad student, like I barely get like a 2.5. Like I was not going to class. And, you know, I guess everyone in college kind of knew of the e-commerce brand that I was running, because we would actually partner with like local clubs. Like we actually would do stuff at like the Hard Rock Hotel on like Saturdays and Sundays. They'd have pool parties and they'd give us a booth there. I knew one of like the main promoters there. And I was like 19 going to the club, like holding a like box of like sunglasses. And so they'd never ID me because they just assumed that I was like of age, and we'd get in like early and I'd be always carrying the inventory. And I'd bring some like older, you know, college friends with me. And they'd give us like bottles for like so cheap. And we'd just get drunk and sell sunglasses on Saturday and Sunday during the summers. And you know, we could make like $2,000-$3,000 a day selling sunglasses at these events. It was like pretty epic. And it was a lot of fun too. Like we would have this kind of, our pitch was like, you know, our sunglasses, they're polarized. So when you put on the polarized and you show like this special film, everyone's like, whoa, like these are so cool. And like, oh, they would sell themselves. It was awesome. But yeah, I mean, I was never really into college and in school and going to class and whatnot. I was always, you know, doing things out of school, whether it be, you know, running this e-commerce business or, you know, flipping different products and whatnot. So when I graduated, actually, this was junior year of college, or actually maybe sophomore year of college, I started writing for entrepreneur.com. I became a contributing writer to like Entrepreneur, Huffington Post, the Next Web, Forbes, like all these major media outlets. And at the time it was crazy. Like people were paying $1,000, $2,000, $3,000 for just like a link in one of these media outlets. Is when like SEO is really driven by like these do follow backlinks. And at the time the media outlets, you know, had those type of links. And so my side hustle, you know, at the time was like a PR agency. And so when I, you know, was traveling Europe, I was like making a few $1,000s a month, just like writing articles and helping people get press coverage. And so I was running a little, you know, PR agency after I sold, you know, that e-commerce business. And after like 9 months abroad, I spent, you know, 3 months, I actually lived in Tel Aviv, and then 6 months just all through Europe, mostly the Mediterranean. I got home to Maryland where I grew up, and my mom's like, hey, you know, you got to get a job. And I remember it was like December, and I had just made like $12,000, like writing like 5 or 6 articles for the month, like of last month. And I was like, why do I need a job? Like, I'm making like, you know, I could make like 6 figures this year. And in the back of my head, I had the idea for Sourcify and really, you know, wanted to pursue it. And so I, you know, told her and told my parents and said, hey, like, I'm going to move back to San Diego. I know like a few entrepreneurs out there. I'm going to start this business called Sourcify. And that's what I did. I mean, I literally just like started, I rented a bedroom and a 3-bedroom apartment and would just work really late and, you know, basically work all day on Sourcify. And you know, that's kind of how that business came to be.
And how'd you land these contracts for like writing for all these like big name magazines? Because I feel like if I hit them up today in 2022, they're gonna be like go fuck yourself now.
Yeah, I mean, right now it's a lot harder. You know, situation has changed a lot. You know, back then college entrepreneurship was all the hype, and so, you know, I became like a college entrepreneurship writer and got to cover a lot of really cool stories. And you know, it was just the right time, to be honest. Like, it was just all about the timing. I think today it is, you know, so much harder to write for these media outlets and get placement. And even the placement too isn't as valuable, to be honest. But, you know, it's still good exposure. So I think it was just the right timing. And I had a good story to share. Like, it was, you know, I thought my writing was pretty good.
You're still coming out with content, right? For a lot of these programs. How do you do that? You know, is that more of kind of personal branding? Are you still, you know, making money on it, or what's the actual goal with coming out and
spending? Yeah, now, I mean, honestly, I don't make money on it. It's just personal branding, and you know, it's fun to do. Like, to be honest, I was never a good writer. Like, I got actually a D in English my junior year of high school. I was like so bad in English class. My like teacher was like, "Yeah, you're never gonna be published, never gonna, you know, be an author or whatever." And in 2018, I actually had a goal for the year to write a book, and so I wrote a book. I published a book in 2018, and it's on Amazon. It's called E-commerce Millionaires, the Underground Playbook of 8-Figure Online Brands. So you guys should check it out. It's pretty good writing, actually.
That's amazing. We'll definitely link that in the show notes below. One of the questions that I had kind of as a follow-up on Sourcify. So at this point now, you guys are, you know, multi-country. I don't know what the word is for that, like international sourcing from all of these different countries. And I want to kind of take it back to that original question I had at the beginning of this call, where like everyone that I know in e-commerce is freaking out about supply chain stuff. And I think from the consumer standpoint, they're slowly seeing that tack on with maybe some prices are going up on certain brands or they're out of stock. But you are kind of like on the front line of that battlefield right there, where you're probably seeing like the worst of the worst firsthand. Can you give people who are listening to this, who maybe don't see it on an everyday basis, like an idea in terms of like what's going on and what's going wrong right now?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, on the supply chain side, you know, costs have risen drastically, especially on the freight side of things. I mean, you used to be able to import a container for, you know, around $4,000 or so. And now, you know, last year and even through this year, rates were, you know, $16,000, $18,000, $20,000 to import a container. And, you know, you're literally bidding the same amount of products in that same container, but costs have, you know, 5x, and it's insane. And so I think on one hand, you know, there's just been a huge increase in demand, but on the other hand too, just the ports, you know, in America have really not been operating very efficiently. Like, they, you know, in Long Beach and LA, they started operating 24/7, which helped a bit. And then also on the Asia side, there was shutdowns, you know, in China, there's a zero COVID tolerance policy. So if there's even like one case, they'll shut down a port for a few days or shut down an area for a few days. So they are a lot more strict on COVID than a lot of, you know, cities and states are in the US. And that kind of created the perfect storm for all these cost increases and delays. I mean, it used to take like 3 weeks or so to, you know, import a container. And now sometimes you hear people taking 3 or 4 months. Like, it's actually insane. And then e-commerce overall, it's gotten a lot harder, I think, to run and operate an e-commerce business. I mean, it's like a shitty storm. Like, on one hand, you had iOS 14 with, you know, tracking being harder to do and ad costs going up drastically. And on the other hand, on your supply chain side, you had costs rising. So on the front and back end, costs are rising for the e-commerce brands. And I think in today's world, you know, I don't want to say that the golden era of e-commerce is gone, but I think it's a lot harder. And I think you have to become a lot more community driven with your brand and niche focused. I mean, you can't just launch like a broad brand anymore. Like it's just not going to happen.
Where does Sourcify actually fit in now on that side? Are you helping people do everything from new product development, finding the factory, mm-hmm. getting it developed, all the way through, I guess, getting into a US-based distribution center?
Yeah, so we handle the full scope from the sourcing perspective. So companies come to us with a problem in their supply chain. They say, hey, our lead time is horrible. Our costs are too high. Our quality sucks. And we say, okay, let's look at this. And, you know, typically on average, when a company works with us, they're saving at least 10% of their costs in production. And we do that by, you know, typically transitioning them to a different factory. And that onboarding process can, you know, take some time, but we handle, you know, the full scope, everything from sampling to production management to auditing the factory to quality control to oftentimes handling freight. We actually feel, you know, booking freight from China and from Asia, we're able to get a lot better rates than working with a lot of these international forwarders. So we're always looking to help our customers cut costs while also improving quality and lead time. And so those are kind of the three main pillars we look at is cost, quality, and lead time.
And if somebody's listening to this right now that's running an e-commerce brand, I'd say, you know, first and foremost, check out Sourcify, because I'm sure you guys can probably save them some bucks and make their lives a little bit easier. But let's say that, like, they're just getting started off and, you know, they want to go and kind of tackle things themselves. Mm-hmm. What are the biggest mistakes that you typically see merchants going and doing when they're getting started?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, most merchants, when they start, they're just on Alibaba or one of these marketplaces searching for a factory. And there's nothing wrong with that. I mean, that's where a lot of these factories are, but I think you should fundamentally first understand how these marketplaces make money. They make money from the supply side. So they're charging these suppliers to be on there. And the more that they pay, you know, to advertise, the higher they're going to rank for certain keywords. So let's say you're looking to start like a backpack brand or whatever it may be. If you search like backpack, you know, nylon supplier on Alibaba, you know, the factory that's paying the most for those keywords is going to rank the highest. So it doesn't necessarily mean that it's the best factory. And so I think there's a lot of misconceptions around that in regards to how Alibaba actually works. And then too, when you're coming in as a new business, as a foreigner, negotiating a good rate is extremely hard to do. And so that's where we also come in with our customers, is negotiating payment terms, making sure they're improving their margin as they grow, and really, you know, being a resource for them with our own boots on the ground. So in China and in Vietnam, we have what's called a wholly owned foreign entity. So our corporation in America actually owns a corporation in China and Vietnam that, you know, full-time employs W-2 employees in both those countries.
Man, it's crazy, because when we were running an e-commerce business that I think we were exporting everything from Shenzhen, I believe it was, and we had this relationship with this factory for like, I want to say it was like 2 or 3 years. And like, we were doing decent order sizes for them. Like, I don't know, probably tens of thousands of every order or something. And they wouldn't give us anything. They wouldn't give us price breaks. They wouldn't give us like really any terms or anything like that. And we flew over one time to go to like one of the global sources fairs over in Hong Kong. And then we actually met them. And then we met them for like all of 45 minutes, I want to say it was. And after that, we got like 60-day payment terms. We got crazy price breaks and nothing changed. We were ordering the same exact amount, but mm-hmm. I've never seen a culture that values in-person communication and relationships as much. Like, it's like almost as if as soon as they saw our faces and met us, they were like, oh yeah, now like, you know, we've confirmed you're good. Like the tens of thousands of dollars you were paying us before, that didn't prove anything. But like, now that I saw you in person, like, I'll give you these good terms.
I mean, I think it goes down to the guanxi. You know, you probably heard that term before in terms of the, you know, business relationships and how far that goes in China. And it really, you know, goes a long way. So I think for us, being able to send our team to these different factories on behalf of our customers and represent, you know, them is the key in the whole puzzle.
Are there any other kind of tips in terms of trying to get better terms, and whether that's pricing with some of these suppliers, either A, if people can't make it down there, or, you know, would you suggest everyone goes to fly down there, anything around that?
I mean, in today's world, you got to quarantine to go over there. So, you know, I used to go to China and Asia in general, like 4 to 8 times a year. And I haven't been in like over two and a half years now since COVID. So, you know, even our business has changed. You know, I used to be there just assisting our kind of general manager over there and going to these, you know, different offices that we have. And I mean, nowadays, you know, as a foreigner, it's really hard to go over there. So, you know, I think in general, you always want to, you know, try to have someone on the ground floor to work with. Like, I know a lot more brands have started to hire kind of their own full-time team members there. And that's something that, you know, we've actually helped people with, is like hire their own full-time sourcing team members, you know, in these countries. So they're actually, you know, on your team, we're working for you, and you know, representing you directly. So I think, you know, in today's world, it definitely is pretty hard because it's, you know, I don't want to quarantine for 2 weeks going to China, but, you know, if you want to do that, go ahead.
Yeah, that makes sense. What I want to start kind of taking this conversation now from Sourcify to Bubble Hotels, because this is a business now that you started, was it 2 years ago?
Yeah, about 2 years ago.
So at this point, for anyone listening to this right now, I'm sure you might have seen some kind of resemblance for kind of what Nathan's building in some of these national parks, but it's a lot of, well, I guess I'll let you to kind of describe, A, what is Bubble Hotels and where did the idea come from?
Yeah, I mean, so Bubble Hotels, we create unique glamping experiences outside of national and state parks. You know, our bubbles enable you to sleep under the stars in the comfort of a nice bed with, you know, full AC and heat and water, septic and electric. So you've got everything you need in there. And each unit has a hot tub too, which is cool. And, you know, the concept actually really stemmed from when I was on a backcountry ski trip in January of 2020. And I was, you know, in the backcountry of Japan, and there was like this yurt with like a clear roof. And I was like, this is the most incredible thing ever. And I, you know, was living in San Diego at the time and had spent a lot of time in Joshua Tree. And it just hit me, you know, someone should create this type of concept in Joshua Tree. And so when I got home, couldn't stop thinking about it. It was serendipitous. Bubblehotels.com was for sale. I bought it for $4,000. I was like, all right, you know, this is a sign. And, you know, I bought 20 acres of land out there myself and just started figuring out how to put the pieces together. But, you know, before I invested more into the development, I wanted to like test demand. And so I launched a crowdfunding campaign on Indiegogo, and we became the most crowdfunded hotel ever. We raised almost $1 million in 30 days, 1,700 reservations. It was very overwhelming because in Joshua Tree, we're only building 10 units. And that kind of what set, you know, the pace for the realization of, wow, there's so much demand here. People want these unique hospitality experiences. And so we, you know, raised a little capital from friends and then, you know, went out and started scouting our second location. So now we haven't necessarily like publicly announced our next development, but, you know, I'll disclose where it's at. It's in Bryce National Park. We've got 149 acres there. And we're actually launching two as part of this development, a much higher end concept that I won't disclose yet, but everyone will hear about it when we go live in the fall.
I feel like that's probably one of the coolest examples of crowdfunding. Yeah, everyone talks about Kickstarter and, you know, you're getting all the money before you develop your product. Mm-hmm. You pretty much pre-sold a hotel reservation, which seems a bit crazy because at the time you only had the land. Had you guys built any units at that point?
No. And here's the thing, you know, that's pretty daunting, I think, about development is, you know, the upfront cost to open your door is very high. So like in Joshua Tree, about, you know, $2.5 million. In Bryce, it's $10 million that we're, you know, spending before we even open our door. But, you know, like real estate, you know, there's you're building an asset, right? And so that asset is valued based on a cap rate and net operating income. And in boutique hospitality, it's, you know, a pretty good time to be building because rates have really increased drastically in terms of average daily rates. So what people are paying every night has gone up and demand is through the roof. So it's really been a blessing to time it right as people, you know, get out of COVID and now want to travel more and more.
So once you raised all the money, so A, you used personal capital, you bought the land, you then went on, you proved out the demand side by pre-selling rates. What did the next kind of couple steps look like? Did you then go and pull in other investors and then?
Yeah, I mean, we should take a step back because like what's even crazier is like in 2020, I didn't do anything in real estate. Like I didn't know anything about development and do anything about hospitality. I was a newbie. And, you know, when I started figuring out how to put the pieces together, it was like a fun puzzle. You know, I think that's what a lot of business is about is like, how do you put the pieces together to make it all happen? And so, you know, in Joshua Tree, a lot of that was around permitting. So I went through the pre-approval process before we launched our crowdfunding campaign to make sure we'd be able to get approvals. And then in Bryce, you know, we got full commercial licenses and permits on our land there, which was a lot, you know, faster to do in Utah than it is in California, just with the way kind of building goes and the way the states operate. But, you know, then I said, let's test demand. And that's when we launched on Indiegogo and it, you know, went kind of viral. A lot of people saw it and then we raised some capital and, you know, now we've basically raised, you know, debt and equity to build. So it's been a whole process of hiring, you know, every sort of engineer you can think of, from, you know, a commercial grade L3 septic engineer to a, you know, electrical engineer to an architect to, you know, you name it, anything you could think of, like we've had to solve. Like, how do you answer how many washers and dryers you need on an 85 unit hotel? And so there's these questions like that that come up that, you know, you as an entrepreneur just have to be able to solve. You know, it's like, I think a lot of entrepreneurs are just ultimate problem solvers.
With Sourcify, it seems really easy from your perception, or maybe not easy, sorry word, but like you had at least started that with like 5+ years of experience of sourcing products overseas. So when it came time to go and teach other people how to go and do it as well, it probably almost seemed like second nature for you, for like, oh yeah, okay, inspect the factory here, go and find these suppliers here, etc. Mm-hmm. When it came, and you could lean on your own personal experience a lot there, when it came to actually go and developing some of these boutique hotels, were you just reading books and consuming content on YouTube like crazy? Were you cold calling all of these engineers saying, hey, teach me what I don't know? Or is it a lot of tapping into your current network of like people who are in real estate and say, hey, let me just sit down with you for an hour, explain to you what I'm going to do, and you tell me everything that I'm not thinking about?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a matter of iteration. Like even with Sourcify, like our first 2 years, we were just putting the pieces together, right? Like, you know, the first few months, it was just me in my living room charging people like $500 to a few thousand dollars to source the product for them. And like, as a one-person team, I grew that to like $20,000 a month in revenue. And then we went through Y Combinator in 2018, and they were like, you should build software around this to make it, you know, more automated. So then we built software and, you know, raised a little capital. And, you know, now or in our third year, we really started to figure it out. You know, that's where we became a 7-figure business. And, you know, now we're, this year we're on an 8-figure run rate. So in the next 12 months, we'll be an 8-figure business, which is pretty awesome. And with Bubble Hotels, I mean, it was honestly a lot of cold calling. Like I remember for Joshua Tree, I literally cold called like 50 general contractors and told them what I'm trying to do. And half of them hung up, and, you know, two of them were like, this is cool. And then I, you know, met with two of them and chose one to work with. And so it was a lot more cold calling, a lot more, you know, watching YouTube. I read a really cool book of the founder of the Four Seasons Hotel. So it's his autobiography, which is just a great read. I mean, I recommend it for anyone. So it was much more like you said, you know, not going off of personal experience, but calling people to learn from them.
And just out of curiosity, the Joshua Tree one, are you guys open and running, or are you still a couple months out?
No, both properties will be open in the fall.
That's so that's actually really impressive then. And if that they're both opening the fall, where the first one is 10 units or so, and that maybe took like 2 years to develop. And it sounds like you can probably, with your experience and knowing what you kind of know now with the J Tree one, that you can go and spin it around and just like really go all in with the Bryce one.
Yeah. I mean, you know, one thing about real estate and just in general is, you know, the bigger you can build, you know, the larger the outcome, right? So our NOI, like net operating income, you know, on 85 units is a lot higher than 10, obviously. So it's the same amount of work, you know. It's like, well, I might as well go big or go home.
At what point did you, I guess, start building up a team, right? Because a hospitality business is not going to be, you know, low on overhead in terms of, you know, do you have managers per site, or, you know, when did you start hiring?
Sure, yeah. So basically the way that a hospitality business or even any real estate development company is structured is typically you have like your OpCo and PropCo. So our operating company is just myself and one other dude named Noah that, you know, we do all of the land scouting, the permitting, the architecture. We talk to the engineers, all of that. And then the PropCo is an LLC that actually owns the real estate and the physical asset at that location. And so that PropCo, you know, employs the, you know, general manager of the property, the cleaning staff, you know, the check-in staff, all of that. So that's the structure. Like you see and hear about a lot of these larger developers that, you know, like an example, Brian Toll from the H-Wood Group, you might've heard of him. He runs a lot of really cool restaurants in LA. Like each one of those restaurants is in its own LLC that has its own capital stack that, you know, oftentimes has its own staff. And then his, you know, operating co, you know, is the one that, you know, actually kind of oversees and, you know, takes a cut and owns all of those restaurants.
Dude, was it a nightmare to find the land around Bryce?
In real estate in general, it's all about finding the deal. You know, it doesn't matter if you're doing duplexes, doesn't matter if you're doing storage units. It's literally all about finding the deal. So, you know, we spend a lot of time scouting land and figuring out what the best location is. I mean, we've probably looked at like 100 different, you know, pieces of land, like in diligence, and visited and like went out there and scoped it out and talked to an engineer and talked to the county and all of that. Finding the deal, I think, is the key in real estate in general.
But I do think the Bryce spot is smart just because like I've been to a couple of national parks in that area, and like y'all are also right next to Zion, if I'm correct. Mm-hmm. So you probably get a little bit, I'm assuming that was probably part of the intention, to get a little bit of traffic from both.
Yeah, for sure. And we have a property we're going to announce in Zion and the Great Smoky Mountains next as well. So, you know, it's all about growth. I mean, that's where we're at, just putting the pieces together.
Did you get bank general, like normal debt as well on these properties? And kind of to branch off of that, did you have to pull in like hospitality people to have on like board of advisors, or how did you kind of convince people to lend you debt?
Yeah, so we have one hospitality developer advisor who's, you know, done a lot of hospitality development. And then with debt, actually we have an SBA 504 loan, which is a $5 million loan, and that's for development.
Damn, that's really cool. Yeah, because I've heard before, like typically with either development or even acquiring land, it's much tougher to get debt on that kind of stuff, especially if you don't have a track record.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, that's why we kind of brought in people that have a track record.
So if you're running, and I know that also you run, you know, one or two other businesses on the side. So you definitely stay busy, for sure. Where would you say, I guess, your time is split up across Sourcify, Bubble Hotels?
So I hired a general manager at Sourcify like 2.5 years ago. And so that freed up a lot of time. I'm in the day-to-day in terms of like strategic, you know, decisions or big accounts or stuff like that, but I'm not, you know, fully running the business or doing the sourcing work anymore at all. And with Bubble Hotels, that's where most of my time is spent.
Okay, cool. That makes sense. I was gonna say, I just have a really obvious question to you, I'm sure, but like that concept is something I think a lot of people want to maybe start trying to do, right? Start this business, build it up, get a cash flowing, and then maybe bring somebody in to manage the team and operations. How do you even begin to do that? Because like from my perception, it's like posting on LinkedIn, post a CEO role on Indeed. Like,
I think a general manager role is important, especially if you want to kind of unlock a lot of your time and kind of take yourself out of the business. I think that's crucial. I think it's a matter of just hiring someone that's smart. Like, I'd rather hire someone that's smart than has like industry experience, because I think a smart person can learn and operate a lot better than someone that has a lot of, you know, industry experience that might not be, you know, the best manager. I think incentives are so crucial. Like, it depends on, you know, what you're trying to do with your business, right? Like, you know, do you want to make sure customer satisfaction is 100%? Do you want to make sure your margin is the highest? Do you want to make sure your, you know, sales are growing the fastest? Like, I think that is really crucial, is, you know, think about the outcome and what incentives on your team are going to align with that. Like, I actually started it, this is crazy story, but I don't know, it's freaking badass, man. Like, this is like the power of entrepreneurship, and I love doing this stuff, and I've tested a lot of ideas for fun over the past, you know, few years. But basically I started like a side hustle January 10th. I had bought a car, registered at Montana. The guy was using, you know, pen and paper to do the registration work, and you register a vehicle in Montana because there's no sales tax. And so I started a side hustle business where we register vehicles in Montana. Hired, you know, one person to go to the DMV every day and handle all of that. And, you know, last month that business did almost $50,000 with like a 33% net margin. And it's just like, it's so hands off. I don't touch it. I think this year we'll do $500,000, like just having started January 10th. So I don't want to disclose the name. I mean, I give hints about the industry and whatnot, but, you know, I think that's what's really fun, is like once you figure out how to put all the pieces together in a puzzle, of starting a business and growing a business, it's a matter of, you know, finding the right problem to tackle or figuring out what's your favorite niche to work on. But it's like also a no-brainer. You know, there's some businesses where like the offer is like just incredibly good. And in the case of like registering a vehicle in Montana, you know, if you're buying a car that's, let's say, even $50,000 and registering it in Florida, that has like a 6% sales tax. So paying, I don't know, $3,500 or so to register it, you can do it in Montana for like, I don't know, a tenth the cost or something. So like I think it's a no-brainer type of offer, but finding, you know, niches like that, I think is really fun to do. And I think definitely some people get, you know, caught up in the hype of like all this VC stuff. Like I know a lot of Sourcify competitors pretty well, and you know, a lot of them have raised more money than us, like drastically more money than us. And we do, you know, more revenue, more business than they do. So I think, you know, raising money isn't a direct correlation to success. And it puts you on that flywheel. Sometimes it's great, you know, if you need money to grow, definitely go out and raise. But you look at like Fast, you know, that like one click checkout company that just went under, and it's like, dude, like you raise $120 million and spend it like all in a year hiring like 600 people or something. It's like, and do like $600,000 in revenue. It's like, I mean, I don't know what to think of that. It's like crazy, you know?
I think a lot of entrepreneurs probably suffer from shiny object syndrome. I know Connor and I do. Kind of sounds like you probably do. I think it just kind of goes hand in hand with starting a company, starting a lot of them. How do you view it? I guess from a time investment, do you sit down and you say, hey, if the opportunity is over X dollars a month, you know, I might look into tackling it. Do you just kind of go after things you're interested in? Do you have any sort of framework around when it makes sense to try to tackle new businesses when you might have a couple others, you know, already running and operating?
I mean, I think you can always check yourself out of a business once it gets to a certain point. Like within, for the first 2 weeks of this, you know, side hustle business, like I took myself out of the business, like, and now maybe I spend like 2 to 3 hours a week on it, like if that. So I think you can take yourself out of the equation a lot and hire someone and incentivize them to do it. Like the person, like, yeah, I mean, it's, there's a lot of ways to, I think it depends on the opportunity, right? Like obviously if you're raising capital and going down that route, like you have to be fully focused and devoting a lot of your time on that. And that's why, you know, vast majority of my time, like, you know, everything from like 9 to 5 is like Sourcify and Bubble Hotels. And now, right now it's mostly Bubble Hotels. So it also depends on the stage and what you're doing, but yeah, I mean, you know, there's definitely a direct correlation between, you know, focus and growth.
You mentioned that when you got back from Japan, you saw the name bubblehotels.com available for $4,000. I mean, literally on the spot, you just bought it. I know most entrepreneurs probably have 10 times the amount of domains in their Namecheap or GoDaddy account than they do actual businesses. Was there another domain or two that you've bought in the past that you were like, at the time, this is going to be a sick business, and now looking back, you're like, I haven't done anything with that. I'm kind of just sitting on it.
Yeah, I mean, so many. Like, I remember back in the day when I was running my own e-commerce brands, and just even with Sourcify, we would use AdSpy a lot, and I felt like you could make AdSpy a lot better. So I bought, like, I don't remember the domain, but it was like adtrackerorsomething.com. And, you know, I created like a cool extension and experience, and actually like built it out, but never did anything with it, to be honest. Like, so I have so many ideas like that where I, you know, buy the domain, even take the steps to build it out, and then don't go anywhere with it. Like there's even this idea, there's a company that's raised a lot of money called Picasso, where they do like fractional vacation home ownership. And they put a home in an LLC and, you know, divide it into like fourths or eighths. So you can buy a fourth of a second home and vacation in it. And I was like, someone should do this with like exotic cars. So I bought a domain around, like, I don't even remember what it was called, but like
fractionallambo.com.
Yeah, exactly. Something like that. And I was like, this would be so badass, but didn't do anything with it, you know?
Yeah. Only so many hours in the day. Now I want to, like, I don't know, for myself personally, I always, and I bring this up a lot, so people who are listening to this probably understand that I really respect people who can run multiple businesses at the same time, just especially someone like yourself who's jumping in between like sourcing to real estate to e-commerce to like literally the stuff with that you're talking about with Montana. Like, I personally think that's really cool. Now, I think one of the other things that I think that you do is cool is like you also just have this pretty sweet lifestyle. Like, you kind of talked about like the fact that you guys would go and just like party at these clubs and like hand out these sunglasses. And like, personally, I'm not a huge fan of like all of the entrepreneurs who just talk all the time about like, you have to wake up at 8 a.m. and go to sleep at like midnight, whatever like that. And just like work. Like, in my opinion, I think if you do it right and you focus on the right stuff, you can have a really fun lifestyle and also get around. Like, I know you said think I saw some tweet or post on LinkedIn where like you moved out to Salt Lake City, you ski like 40 days in the winter. Like, I think that's badass. Like, yeah. Is there a way that you kind of think about like approaching your lifestyle or like your mindset in terms of like the stuff that you want to be doing and want to be working on?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, it's a good question. And, you know, I definitely in my early 20s went through a party stage like a lot of people do. And I was having so much fun. And now, you know, especially where I live in Salt Lake, like I find myself rather getting up early to go skiing or go on an adventure. And like, if it's a powder day, like I set this rule for myself. If it snows more than a foot overnight, like I'm at the mountain in the morning, like 100%, no questions asked. Like my meetings are not happening that morning and I'll go work in the afternoon. And, you know, I get home at 12 and work till 7 or 8. Like that's a full day right there, you know? So I think the beauty of, you know, being an entrepreneur is being able to, you know, create your own schedule and, you know, really create the lifestyle that you want to build. And I think now I've kind of prided myself on being able to do that, you know, where I live here in Salt Lake City. I mean, I love it. If anyone's ever around, hit me up. Happy to, you know, show them around or take them out. And, you know, in terms of, I guess, questions I ask myself before I do something, it's typically number one, will it be fun? And number two, will I regret not doing it in the future? So those are kind of the two questions I like to ask. And, you know, sometimes it turns into a great adventure and sometimes it turns into a shit show.
You had a cool tweet about being out of shape and working out and how much it costs. And I really like the way that you framed it in terms of, I believe you said, okay, most people might not pay $250 a month to get into shape, but if you reverse it, would you allow someone else to pay you $250 a month to be out of shape? Mm-hmm. I thought that was a pretty interesting way of looking at it. Reminded me a lot of, I think Naval pushes his framework too on, you know, figure out how much you want to value yourself on an hourly perspective. Mm-hmm. Is whatever task you're doing above that amount? Are there any sort of other frameworks that you kind of use to either stay motivated or kind of keep pushing yourself on?
Yeah, I mean, it's a great, great question. And I love Naval. And I've been on such like a workout grind and I'm very routine driven. Like even when I'm traveling, I'll go to the gym every day. Like I'll, you know, make sure I have my coffee in the morning, stretch in the morning. Like I'm very routine driven. And when I'm at home, I actually work out like twice a day. I'll go in the morning and then lift at night. So I just love, like, that's my meditation. You know, some people need that like meditative release. For me, it's like going to the gym. Like I love that time. You know, in terms of frameworks, honestly, I'm pretty traditional when it comes to like getting stuff done. You know, I use like pen and paper, like a notepad that I have like next to my computer, and I'll just write down like important tasks that I want to accomplish. And then, like I said, I think like, so for example, with this, Montana, you know, registration business, we're starting to do car shipping, transportation of vehicles, because a lot of our customers ask, well, can you also ship our vehicle? And so I just, you know, one day sat down for like an hour and I said, okay, how do I like legally do this? And, you know, we had to get a United States Department of Transportation registration. We had to get insurance. Like we had to get, you know, the login to like this dispatch marketplace. And so putting the pieces together and trying to like figure out and understand, like, you know, how do you start, I think is so crucial. And then the next question is, well, how do I, you know, get customers? How do I get the traffic? And, you know, I think everyone knows in entrepreneurship, like sales solves everything. You know, if you're having a lot of sales and overall with sales, it's a very good thing, which is what we experienced at Bubble Hotels, like 1700 reservations in a month. I was like, holy shit, like this is crazy. And, you know, it's a good but also scary feeling, right? Because, you know, especially with that business, we're creating a experience for people to, you know, really feel comfortable in Mother Nature and really just connect with the outdoors. So, you know, in terms of frameworks, I think like, honestly, people should do what they want to do and care less about what other people think. I think so many people are kind of wrapped up. And don't get me wrong, like I'm on Instagram, I'm on Twitter, I'm all on social media, but, you know, I try not to care what people think most of the time.
Yeah, well said. The last thing that I personally want to wrap up on, and we can throw it over to Gio if he has anything else, but if you're 27 today and you've done a hell of a lot of stuff that I feel like anyone at pretty much any age would be impressed by. Is there like a goal that you're working towards that like, hey, by the time I'm 40, I want to be doing this. By the time I'm 50, I want to be doing this. Like, is there like a vision that you kind of set for yourself that you're trying to follow?
Yeah, I mean, honestly, they're shorter term goals. I make my goals very like attainable. So I am goal driven. Like every year I'll sit down and even through the year, I'll kind of analyze my goal. So this year, one fitness, well, I guess I'll start. So last year, my fitness goal was learn to headstand. I accomplished that. I can headstand like pretty, like very well now, actually. It's pretty cool. This year, personal goal is get to 12% body fat. So I'm, you know, been cutting and want to, you know, cut and get down to under 12%. So I go get a DEXA scan every, you know, 2 or 3 months that, you know, analyzes my whole body. And in terms of business goals, you know, it's growth minded for sure. I mean, you know, I know with Sourcify, we've always wanted to be a $10+ million business, and, you know, we're on the right path to get there. And with Bubble Hotels, you know, our main goal right now is opening Joshua Tree and Bryce this year. I think kind of mixed of business and personal is like, this year I want to buy a McLaren. So I've been shopping for a McLaren. I'm actually going to see one in like 30 minutes.
Now you know how to register it too.
Yeah. So that would be cool. And then I also wanted to learn to fly. And so I've done 8 hours of my private pilot's license, but on my 6th hour, we had like a little engine malfunction. I got a little sketched out by that, to be honest, and realized it wasn't like the most practical thing to learn. But, you know, that one's on pause right now. So we'll see.
Dude, it's okay. That's so funny you mentioned that. And this is doesn't have anything totally to do with the flying stuff. But like, last time I was actually out in Utah, I was like, ah, oh, fuck it. Like, I'm going to go skydiving. Like, I've always wanted to like go skydiving before. So we did it over, it's either Moab or maybe Arches or something like that. And I just remember going up on the plane. I was like, huh, like, I do really have a good life right now. Like, it would kind of suck if this didn't work out. And it, like, I got to imagine that's probably the same thought that you went through with the flying stuff. It's like I still ended up jumping out of this plane. Yeah. But I'd imagine like, you're like, yeah, the hobby's probably not worth
it. Well, yeah. And I was kind of like, you know what, maybe I should wait till I can buy like a jet and have someone else fly it for me.
There we go.
So maybe, you know, give me 10, 15 years and we'll be on my jet.
The last question to wrap it up on, I'm really intrigued on some of the organizations you're part of. I believe you're, was it Young Entrepreneurs Organization? I think they rebranded to just
EO. EO Entrepreneurs Organization.
How do you kind of view, I guess, networking as a whole? Have these organizations made a drastic impact? You know, should other people kind of look into joining things like that?
Yeah, you know, EO has been so fantastic in my life, both business and personally. I mean, you know, EO is called Entrepreneurs Organization. It's a global network of founders. You know, each city you have to be hitting certain revenue numbers to be a member. And then typically in a city, there'll be like 100 to 300 members. And each membership is broken down into forums of like 7 people. So I've been in a forum in San Diego and now in a forum in Utah. And both ones have been fantastic because you really are able to share what they call like the bottom and top 5% of both your life and business. You know, things that would be hard to share with, you know, a close friend or even family or, you know, whatever it may be. It's kind of like you're almost like group therapy, but it's more growth minded and supportive.
Cool. All right. Well, Nathan, where can people find you online if they want to kind of keep up and follow along with what you're doing?
Yeah. Just Nathan Resnick on Twitter or LinkedIn. I think my Twitter is NateRez94 and then Instagram, NateRez, NateRez. And yeah, if anyone's in Salt Lake, hit me up. We'd love to host you and show you around.
Awesome. Appreciate you coming on. We'll make sure to link to everything below.
If you thought today's episode was awesome, we would love it if you would leave a 5-star review on the podcast, either on Spotify or Apple Podcasts. It makes a huge difference and lets us get cooler and cooler guests for future episodes.